This is Mouth Media Network. Amplify and connect.
Hi, this is John Dempsey, Executive Group President at the Estee Lauder Companies. And beauty is my life. Beauty is my job. Beauty is my passion. Beauty is my inner peace, my soul, and my aspiration.
This powerhouse extraordinaire has created multiple phenomena in the beauty industry with his unique career path and compelling social media presence. From taking MAC Cosmetics from a small brand to a global powerhouse and identifying Tom Ford as a cultural icon to disrupt the fragrance category. He identifies with pop culture to recognize and set the stage for what is new and next. You will hear his heart, soul, passion, and purpose in everything that he does for the industry and for the people he shares his life with. From his 12-year-old VSCO girl to his 10 amazing four-legged friends, John Dempsey makes the magic happen when art and science converge.
From New York City, you're listening to Beauty is Your Business, covering the intersection of innovation and business in the beauty industry.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm good.
It's fantastic seeing you here on the Beauty is Your Business podcast.
Well, beauty actually is my business, and it's good being on the podcast. So,
well, we're excited to dig in. First, I'd like to welcome my co-host, Karen Moon.
Hi, everyone.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Nice meeting you.
So we're really excited to get to know about the world of John Dempsey.
Oh, and my goodness.
To dig in a little bit into your personal journey in the beauty industry and hear about some of the highlights and things that you've done as a powerhouse and branding expert in the beauty industry for so many years. So, John, tell us a little bit about your journey and some of the highlights that you've experienced.
Oh my gosh. The journey always begins in Once Upon a Time. Born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio. Grew up basically as a Midwestern kid. My mom was a painter, my dad, an industrialist. Went to Stanford University, studied economics and French literature, but always had a love and passion for the arts, culture, storytelling, advertising, and funnily enough, beauty. When I was growing up, my grandmother actually had a first cousin who was a guy named Bernie Mitchell, who was the guy who actually created Jovan Musk in the 70s, which was like the sex pheromone fragrance of the sort of Woodstock generation. So I always had in the back of my mind, in a family setting, somebody who did something in the beauty business and fragrance that was more glamorous than growing up in Ohio. And he lived in Chicago, which is not as glamorous as New York, but is way more glamorous than Cleveland. You know, I then went to NYU Business School and basically lived in Paris for a while and was super interested in beauty. Actually, when I graduated business school in the early 80s, I needed to get a job or else I had to go back to Ohio. And I had interviewed at all the companies. I'd met Estee Lauder. I'd met Charles Revson. I'd met all these sort of icon founders of the industry, but ended up actually in retail and began my life working in the executive training program at Macy's. Rosemary Bravo gave me my first job. I'm here to tell you that I was not successful in my first job. I went from Macy's to Bloomingdale's to Saks to Benetton, actually, and spent the first 10 years of my career working in retail as a buyer in fragrance, makeup, skincare, and basically got to know the business during the big 80s. When that was all about the glamorous fragrance launch or the exciting Boté launch or the skincare scientific phenomenon. And I learned from the ground up. And from my retail experience, I went to work for Revlon and actually worked on Princess Marcella Borghese, which was a specialty store business back in the day. You know, people always say that, you know, I'm not an overnight sensation. I logged and clocked a lot of hours and miles working on every level of this business, from the shop floor to the advertising piece, to the financial piece, to the marketing piece, and arrived in Estee Lauder 30 years ago this February. And I was not an overnight sensation. Actually, I arrived at 35 years old. I was lucky in that when I arrived, Leonard Lauder was still at the helm of the company, and Estee Lauder was still alive. And I actually began my career actually running the West Coast office for the Estee Lauder brand. And for the first 7 years with Estee Lauder, I worked on the Estee Lauder brand and worked with the Lauder family and knew Estee Lauder and worked with lots of icons of the beauty business, like, you know, Robin Burns and Leonard Lauder and all sorts of other amazing people and product developers. And life was good. But the turning point in my career actually came when I received or got the honor of the assignment to work on MAC Cosmetics. And that was in 1998. And at the time, interestingly enough, I was going to leave Estee Lauder. I had another job. And Leonard had actually offered me another position in the company. And I said, well, I don't really think that that really is going to move the mark. And he said to me, what about MAC? And I had no idea what it meant when I said, absolutely, what about MAC? I'm in. And when I joined MAC, it was the first external acquisition our company had ever made. It was the indie brand founded by Frank and Frank in Toronto. And it was a bit in trouble, amazing, with an amazing product lineup, an amazing soul, amazing spirit. And everything that I've done for the last 22, nearly 23 years here at the Estee Lauder Companies, MAC has been part of my life. So my first job where I actually got to put my own opinion or develop my own team or to make a difference was with MAC. But I built MAC on the incredible foundation of the founders of the brand, the amazing people that were in the brand, the artistic soul of all those people that are still with the brand. And in MAC, I was able to learn and understand the power of makeup to transform people's lives from a cultural perspective, from a beauty perspective, and actually from a charitable and societal perspective. And, you know, the MAC credo back then was all ages, all races, all sexes, all MAC. Now we say all genders. But the notion of the diversity inclusion of what the brand represented and the notion of makeup artistry and the authenticity of the brand message and the honesty in terms of the product and the connection with pop culture and developing a business for aspirational communities around the world is the job that could only come once in a lifetime. And at MAC, I was able to meet, learn, engage, play with, collaborate with most of the amazing fashion designers and pop culture talents of the last 25 years through the work that we did with MAC Viva Glam and the MAC AIDS Fund, which is now the MAC Viva Glam Foundation, raising over $500 million for when men, women, and children affected by HIV and AIDS, by building out the whole notion of backstage beauty and the whole drop collaboration model, which has been embraced by the entire apparel and accessory and makeup world, and building out powerful brand franchises and building out powerful, meaningful connections with different cultures around the world. So there was a chapter 1, 2, 3, but my arrival at Mac really was the first time that people got to see, and I got to see what I was able to really do. I guess the other watershed moments from Mac, I went back and was able to work on the Estee Lauder brand and brought along Jane Hertzmark-Huddis and worked with her to take the Estee Lauder brand on its trajectory to where it is today. And I was lucky and fortunate to have made the acquaintance of Tom Ford, actually during the time period when Tom left Gucci, brought Tom to the Estee Lauder brand on a collaboration, and created Tom Ford Beauty from the ground up under the guidance, the brilliance, and the creativity of Tom Ford and an amazing team of Estee Lauder Company's executives. And I do believe that as MAC sort of revolutionized the idea of makeup artistry, inclusion and diversity in makeup, Tom Ford actually revolutionized the whole notion of bringing designer luxury and aspiration into modern day sort of high-end fragrance and makeup. So I've worked on a lot of brands. I continue to work on, I've worked on almost every brand within our portfolio here at the Estee Lauder Companies. But if you were to ask me, what are the two brands that personally I made my strongest mark on, it would be MAC and Tom Ford.
So John, I have a question on that. It's interesting, like looking back, it feels like these are all the smart playbook moves, but actually when you started at MAC, you created the playbook.
I did.
Working with fashion designers was a new thing, working with makeup artists in the way that you did. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you brought people along the journey?
Well, first of all, when I took the job at MAC, it was considered to be career suicide and a huge risk. So no one wanted to take the job because nobody completely understood it. There wasn't really a playbook. And now I understand I really could have failed. And it all could have gone very wrong. And by the way, the same thing on Tom Ford. When we started it, there were a lot of naysayers.
Right.
A lot of naysayers who didn't believe that it could be done. And shared the carnage of all the failed designer beauty brands of the last 30 or 40 years. And I always try to embrace everything, never with the assumption that it's not going to be successful, but trying to figure out what the connectivity is or who the customer is or what the authentic angle or mission is to be a success. And Leonard Lauder taught me my guiding principle. My guiding principle in business and in beauty is the answer is always in the room. So when I came to MAC, and I walked into the room with everybody wearing black and all those artists terrified of what was going to happen to this counterculture brand coming into what was perceived as sort of a conservative big global company, I looked to the people in that room to tell me what their passions and dreams were and why they thought the brand was successful and what their personal stories were, and used that as the leverage point to build the brand. So it wasn't my idea to have the first fashion support. I mean, actually, MAC supported fashion shows in Canada, helping a local trade association and local activist charities raising money during the time of the AIDS pandemic, and was working with photographers, models, and makeup artists who actually happened to be from Toronto. So as luck would have it, Walter Chin, the photographer, was from Canada. Frances Hathaway, who went to London to do Princess Diana's makeup, was from Canada. Floria Sigamonde, who did all those amazing sort of rock and roll videos, was from Canada. Linda Evangelista was from outside of Toronto in Canada. And she was using her Spice lip pencil. So all these Canadians left Toronto and went on to conquer the world. So the supermodels, the makeup artists, the hairstylist. So there was this sort of indie spirit and appreciation of all the beauty indies of what MAC was. I always like to say that MAC probably never could have been created the way that it was in New York City or in Paris. Maybe London, maybe Berlin, probably today Los Angeles. But, you know, MAC was an unconventional brand with an unconventional approach, but a fundamental understanding of makeup, aspiration, what people wanted. It wasn't a marketing ploy. It was a lifestyle, and it was a belief system, and it still is. Actually, I believe that most brands that are successful need to have amazing consumer-centric, amazing products that are loved with cherished trial and repeat. But you also have to have a brand that you trust and a belief system that you buy into. And some people can do the product piece and some people can do the belief system piece, but tying them together in a continuous circle to make something into a real business is magic. So the playbook of direct-to-consumer, retail, dot-com, community management, influencer, backstage, emerging fashion designer, theatrical production, Black Lives Matter, being centric to understanding local culture, whether it's in Japan, Korea, China, Chicago, Canada, you know, Dubai, Russia. I mean, the thing about the brand that always brought me back to the truth was the customer was ultimately the star. Mm. And the product was the way that you got to be the person who you wanted to be.
That's the secret sauce, John.
Yes.
The customer. It's always about the customer, right?
Well, you know what? Estee Lauder taught us that. When I started at Bloomingdale's, I used to have to work on Sundays, every other Sunday. I used to feel very sorry for myself when all my other friends were off having brunch or doing things that we're not doing these days. And I remember every Sunday at around 2 o'clock, Estee Lauder would come into the store and they would call me out of my office and she would sit down and start doing people's makeup. She was well into her 80s at that point. Mm. Here was one of the pioneers of the beauty business who to the very final years of her life wanted to sit down with customers and actually touch their face and interact with them.
That's so cool.
That's awesome. So coming up, John gets deeper into what's current and next for Estee Lauder and his take on the beauty industry overall and where it's headed.
As an American, there is no greater privilege and responsibility than choosing who will represent you and your family to determine the course of history, your lives, the economy, your health, your safety. On November 3rd, please choose to vote. To vote early, or if you need an absentee or mail-in ballot, please visit vote.org. Your future self thanks you.
So, John, you've really had such a fascinating journey, and we deeply appreciate your insights, your enthusiasm, and your love of the industry. Estee Lauder sharing that story about a beautiful woman who had a dream, and she lived that dream until the final years of her life, which is pretty remarkable. It's something for us all to admire and aspire to. But let's talk a little bit about today and where the world is headed and the industry. And I know you talk a lot about high tech, high touch. Where is it headed? COVID has really changed our world. How are we going to move forward and continue to not only educate the beauty consumer, but inspire her and lead her in the direction where she feels fulfilled on the beauty journey for herself?
Well, clearly the last 7 months are unprecedented, at least in anyone we know's lifetime. COVID has accelerated many of the tendencies and things that were taking place in business and society and probably made them happen 4 or 5 or 6 years earlier than anticipated. So the notion of frictionless shopping or of online social community engagement and commerce, these things were happening against the backdrop of physical retail and the change that was taking place in the mall, on the high streets, and such. And the evolution of the influencer dynamics and the media platforms, whether it be Snap or Google, YouTube or Facebook, Instagram, or our summer sensation, TikTok, or the Alibaba or Weibo ecosystem in China, this new way of communicating and these new ways of selling have put pressure on our business to think in new ways and talking about ourselves in new ways, but at the same time have created these unbelievable unique opportunities to tell stories and to connect with people who are like-minded or want to discover or go further with you. The categories are disrupted. I mean, this is a huge period right now. You know, the physical retail is opening up around the world right now. And we've seen the future, at least for the short term. We see life going back to whatever some sort of new normal is in most of Asia right now. And we're slowly emerging out of it in the Western world and here in the U.S. And we're seeing different cycles in terms of the way things people are relating to beauty, self-care, expression, fashion, and their lives. And yes, there's an existential moment when you're watching TV and you see millions of people suffering and out of work, and you see people fearful for what will be the future of humanity and how will I get out of bed, or why should I care, or will I care, or will I get dressed again? Or will I groom myself again? Or will I make myself pretty or handsome or whatever again? Will I ever go out to dinner? Will I ever party? Will I ever see a show? And when this all first started, it seemed like it was going to be a couple of weeks, then a month, then the reality of all this sort of hit. And there was a huge sort of introspective moment where people were very focused on themselves, their family, their health, their safety, their belief system, and their personal space, and a reprioritization in terms of what's important. So on the top of the hierarchy of needs, feeling comfortable, safe, taking care of yourself, feeling good about yourself were the most important things. And your personal vanities or your personal expression went sort of less important. So we saw in the beginning of this an absolute explosion in terms of people's involvement in their skincare routines. And really, when I mean routines and regimens, because people actually had the time to spend on their skincare and their self-care. And people started taking baths and taking a longer shower or taking care of their hair. So the first signs of green shoots here were that we saw an incredible increase in moisturizers, serums, sensorial bath products, candles, home products. So for our heritage skincare brands like Clinique and Estee Lauder, there have been very good things about this that have made those pillars of business very strong. Then you might ask, well, what of our makeup businesses? What happens when, you know, you don't wear lipstick every day or less often? The good news for us is Zoom requires putting a face forward. And people slowly got the hang of, actually, I do need to do a little something, something, or I do need to focus a little bit on how I project or present myself. And as people start going out into the world wearing a mask, people are wearing a lot of eye makeup. So there is a renewed focus on brow, on lashes, on shadow. And people are concerned about the wear of their lipstick underneath their mask if they're going to take it off. So you see various stages of people interfacing or consuming beauty in different ways. So probably fundamentally, our behavior has changed. So for a generation or for people that are older that never felt comfortable buying things online or communicating in a virtual way, that pain point or that barrier has been removed. The notion of trend and community and seeing the wildfire adaptation of dance on TikTok. Of course, I like to talk. I have a 12-year-old daughter who is bougie, ratchet, and savage all summer long and doing the dance that she shouldn't be doing. So I see all of a sudden, you know, my daughter went from being a VSCO girl.
A VSCO girl?
A VSCO girl.
What's that? I don't know about that.
Okay, well, this is something that I didn't even know. A VSCO girl. Someone had asked me if my daughter was a VSCO girl last October. There's been a lot of conversation. Was the makeup explosion of the world over? And why was makeup slowing down? VSCO is a filter on Snapchat. And VSCO girls wear their hair in a top knot. They use glowing sort of highlighting powder and gloss. They carry Hydro Flask and wear crop Save the Turtle t-shirts.
I missed the memo on this. I'm so upset.
And Birkenstock. And I got to tell
Wait,
you something.
Birkenstock.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
I need a picture.
Well, I don't even know. It was living in under my nose. I didn't even know. I had a VSCO girl. And I started asking all the young mothers that I work with, do you know what a VSCO girl is? Of course you know what a VSCO girl is. It's X, astral, alley-oop. You know, so there's a whole vernacular
culture.
And then there are the e-girls. And I thought, like, all of a sudden, my daughter wanted to look like Billie Eilish. And then there are the girls who want to look like Blackpink. And there are the Euphoria girls. So in a time where no one was going out, you start seeing young people starting to play roles and fantasies and start to put it out there again. So the idea of self-expression,
yes,
or human adornment, or of showing off or having fun or trying to feel good about yourself is universal. And I know people say, well, how? You're not a first-line responder. You're not an essential core business. Is beauty a business that goes away in the time of COVID? And actually, I believe that beauty is a universal truth and a universal aspiration, and that everybody wants to feel good about themselves and project their best self. And it is an aspiration that no one is ever fully satisfied with. You always strive for more, for better, whatever your value system is. And that men and women and children will forever want to feel that way. It's just the societal norms will change, or the way that you'll buy the product may change. But the idea of actually wearing and using products to project yourself is as old as time itself.
Well, I think what you hit on is very interesting about creative expression, right? We are living in that world where people want to, they've always wanted to be noticed, but now there's so many ways for them to be noticed that never existed before, like the TikTok, like the Instagram, like all of these channels, which is really compelling. I think a lot about how those media platforms will also translate to not just branding and marketing, but to selling product in a way that ignites the future of shopping.
Well, I've seen the future. It's called Tmall. If you look at the ecosystem, in China, which is fairly closed in, the internet, the influencers, the content, the social chat, and the shopping come together.
Do you see live shopping happening, translating here in the US?
We're certainly giving it a very big push. Mm-hmm. I believe we're close to the tipping point. I will tell you what we've seen mm-hmm. is the reemergence of HSN and QVC. Mm-hmm. So funnily enough, people love watching people talking about and demonstrating beauty products on TV or on social media. And I believe that we're about to see the tipping point of that actually going direct to consumer as well. So yes, it's not quite at that point yet, but you see signs of it.
Right. John, I wanted to switch gears a little bit. I hear you're referred to as the creative of suits
yep.
and the suit are the created guys. That's so important in our industry. Few people have the empathy truly to go so fluidly in between. How do you leverage this to motivate and lead different types of people? And how do you train like the people you mentor, you know, and hone their leadership skills?
Well, first of all, the line is people never know how to define me. Mm-hmm. I'm always viewed as the creative guy to the suits and the suit to all the creative guys. And I do have innately a sense of culture and a sense of intuition, which I do think plays a role in our business. But in today's consumer-powered, data-enabled world, the ability to connect creativity, intuition, and real marketing and real analytics is unbelievably powerful. And, you know, at our company, you know, our CEO Fabrizio Freda has brought this an amazing sort of rigor and vision in terms of merging the best of the high touch, intuitive aspects that the Estee Lauder brand and companies was built upon, and the marketing rigor and analytics of what it takes to be successful in today's business environment and for tomorrow. So I always try to understand the problem or the solution or the aspiration, first and foremost, from the customer's perspective and from who all the stakeholders are, and understanding the way that they see it. And I always find that, though this has been a lot of stress these past few months, sometimes amazing things come when things are most at stress. When you're forced to choose, when you're forced to understand what matters and what doesn't, and to understand what's a root and what's an anchor, sometimes it's very liberating. And I think in this period, it's given me and a lot of other people that I work with the freedom to question the norm and to question why we did it one way or the other way, and to really start to focus more on what's the why behind as opposed to the what. And we work in an industry that focuses sometimes too much on the what and not enough on the why.
Can you share a little bit what you mean by what that means? What's the what and the why?
Because we get very task-oriented. Mm. And it's a natural tendency in when anything is successful to be inspired by and driven by what others are doing.
Mm.
And there is a commercial weight or logic to behavior or launching or doing things that are driven by, you know, market dynamics. But at the same time, you don't get to breakthrough unless you get to understanding what people's desires are and not just always going to a playbook. So doing product A, B, C, and D, new and improved, with the same formulaic communication, the same formulaic ingredients, the same formulaic way of doing it, know, at a certain point, comes to a point of diminishing returns. And I think with the digitization of the communication and the business models, it's brought a lot of disruption into our business. And you see a lot of entrepreneurs and you see a lot of scientists and you see a lot of ingredient houses and you see a lot of things fighting for share of mind. I believe that people go directly to the execution and they forget why they're executing what they're executing, what they're trying to accomplish.
Do you think there'll be a lot more risk-taking now because of so many things that have happened in the past 8-9 months and companies like Estee Lauder and other big businesses who have the market share will start to take more risks to meet the consumer need in the market and at retail and in digital? I mean,
first of all, the nice thing about taking a risk digitally, unless you do something that gives you a reputational risk or hurts your standing within the overall society, is you can experiment and iterate and market differently to different people and make different connections. And if something's not, doesn't work, you can take it down and do it again. So the idea of shooting the big TV commercial, market testing it, and then being stuck with it for 24 months is gone forever. Today, when you shoot something for a product, I need 1,000 assets. I need short form videos of 3 and 6 seconds. I need immersive influencer communication that could go an hour. So the ability to disrupt or to do things differently has never been greater. That's the good news. The bad news is it's available to everybody. And getting share of mind and understanding the science of what you need to pay for in order to be seen and what you need to earn in terms of what it is that you have to say that's organic is a science and an art. And I do believe our business is becoming more a convergence of that science and that art.
You're so right. It is. It's the convergence. Yeah. It's taken a long time to get to that convergence, actually. So I think it's an exciting moment in time where there are so many possibilities and opportunities.
Well, what it means is that everybody can be a winner.
That's good. So, that's a good thing.
It's good.
we want winners. We want to empower people.
There's a market for everybody. Mm-hmm. And there's a big enough market for everybody if you get it right and you have your economics right. The mistake people make is trying to be everything for everybody and being nothing. Mm-hmm. So today, a point of view and a point of difference or a unique selling proposition matters more.
Very well said. Coming up, we're going to get personal with John Dempsey as we have our segment called Hit the Pan. John, you're going to love this, where we explore the human side of John and how he lives his life and has a good time.
Hey, Dresden, do you like to laugh?
Oh, Mark, heartily, heartily.
Elsie, do you like comedy?
Yeah.
I like to laugh at Elsie.
I know, me too. Well, you can listen to Funny People Talking every week. It's a podcast, and we talk about humor and comedy. And honestly, we can barely get through a commercial. But I promise you'll have a good time here. And we talk to amazing people, comedians, business leaders, inspiring people about their lives and about humor, about comedy. We play improv games.
Babble.
We babble, we talk about...
You'll be inspired and you'll laugh. That's why he has a co-host.
That's right. We have great food, celebrity stories, and we always play an improv game. So come on by. You'll have a great time. Funny People Talking, wherever the best podcasts are found.
So, John, let us tell you a little bit about the Hit the Pan segment.
And now it's Hitting the Pan.
Okay.
We have a salon chair. It's actually in my kitchen. Okay. And we're going to spin that chair. And the chair is going to land on someone. It will probably land on myself or Karen. So I'm going to spin the chair. And then we're going to ask you a personal question. So I'm going to spin.
Which is like truth or dare.
Yeah, exactly. I told you we were going to have a good time.
It's Madonna.
I promised you a good interview.
Okay, let's spin the bottle.
Even better. Great game.
Yes.
So I'm spinning the chair.
I would have put on more layers of clothing had I known.
Do you have your lipstick on?
I got a lip balm. So
all right. We put lipstick on, Karen and I. We're both in red lip. I rarely bring out the red lip.
I'm radish today, but
I think mine's Mac. Anyway, so we're going to spin the salon chair, and it's actually going to land on Karen.
Okay.
So 2020, quite the year.
Mm-hmm.
But let's look forward. Fast forward a bit. It's October 2021,
mm-hmm.
12 months from now. Looking back, what were the three most amazing things that had happened for you?
Personally, I learned that I could not go out to dinner every single night of my life and be perfectly fine. I learned more the importance of family and values and those connections that matter. And I became addicted to the unconditional love of animals.
Tell me more. Do you have puppies?
I'm actually almost to be arrested a case of having too many emotional support animals. Yes. I have 7 dogs and 3 cats. So I have 10 animals.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
And there are 2 COVID arrivals in the mix here. So I have a little baby girl pug named Bella. And I have a golden doodle named Biscuit. And they're my COVID puppies. And unlike the other animals, these dogs don't know of ever being a day without me.
Aww.
So I sit at work with these 2 dogs basically like at my side. So I don't know. I don't know if ever in my entire life I ever would have had that type of sort of relationship with nature or understanding, but very strange time I found that.
That's so beautiful.
Actually, thinking about it, so I don't know if you remember, we met several years ago. And one thing I will always remember about you, I get a Christmas card every year.
Yes.
But I do remember on the Christmas card, there's like, I remember one with a lot of pets.
Animals.
So I guess, yeah.
We keep adding them.
Oh, that's so
all
sweet.
All right. Well, we need to see a picture of all of them. Sounds very special.
For
all right. So we're going to spin that salon chair again, and it's going to land on me.
Surprise, surprise. Yes.
So, John, we've been connected for a while now. And one thing I have to talk about is your Instagram. You have really been such a force on Instagram with your wit, your humor, your integrity, your sexy photos. I mean, every time, I haven't seen it in a while. I don't know why. Maybe I'm not in your algorithm. I'm like, where's John Dempsey? But you have really rocked it out, and in a way that you get to know you and who you are and what you love. And you make me laugh all the time, and I thank you for that.
Okay.
So tell us about the inside behind what you're doing. Yeah, what are you doing?
Okay. So how did I turn into the beauty business's meme dealer? So it's
the
volume. No, first of all, I started doing it. Actually, the first Instagram post I ever did was 4 years ago at a photo shoot with Ariana Grande. And when we had signed Ariana Grande for Mac, there's a woman who works with us, Carrie Neer, who's amazing. And she said to me, you need to go on to Instagram. And I go, how do I do that? And she's, look, we're going to take this picture and we're going to post it. And it's original content. Most of the time, I repost things. And things that are like from brands that I work on or funny things that I see or things that are maybe not so PC or I shouldn't be posting. And it sort of just became something that was sort of a fun thing for me to do. I was just doing it because it was like scrapbooking or something. It was just something I was enjoying. And somewhere along the way in the last year and a half, more and more people started coming up to me and saying, God, you know, I love what you're totally crazy. You know, you do everything you're not supposed to do. You you flood, you overpost, you're manic, you do all these different things. But I love seeing it. I love seeing these bursts. And when the pandemic started and so many people were shut at home or isolated, all of a sudden people started reaching out to me and saying, you know, you made me laugh today.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how I would have made it through these months and things. And I started picking up like thousands of people starting to follow me. And sometimes I'll get like 1,000 people and it'll get reposted like 3,000 times. And it became something that just was sort of organic. And I put the people that I work with in global communications, because is it really appropriate for someone in my business profile to be doing something so silly sometimes, or to be doing something that so could be viewed as not appropriate or age appropriate or career appropriate? And that goes to that sort of suit to creative and creative to suits. And I sort of live a little bit with that tension, with that feed. And I've done a couple bad things. I've made some mistakes. I didn't mean to make a mistake or to hurt anybody's feelings. And I'll apologize, or something needs to be taken down, I take it down, because I do it from a point of joy, not from a bad place.
Well, I feel the joy. You always leave me with this smile.
I think it's—
Actually, I'll tell you a very funny one. So I posted one this week. I'd seen one where they had Kris Jenner holding a baby, and it says, Kris Jenner picking up her paycheck, 1994. So I get a DM from Kris Jenner going, John, that's not Kylie, that's Kendall, and it's 1995.
Oh, that's
and I said to her, Kris, your wealth comes from all your children and your love. So I just thought that summed it up. I mean, that just summed it up.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
Well, I think it's fun because it just gives you a window. And by the way, for the listeners, at least from my vantage, I don't know that you mentioned inappropriate or whatever, but like, I don't remember ever seeing anything like that. It's just more like, is a president doing of a company?
No, inappropriate, you know, today.
Age-wise.
I'm the guy who green-lighted at Estee Lauder. Tom Ford,
it's
fucking
awesome.
Fabulous.
So
understand, sitting in the room, launching a product called Fucking Fabulous. And, you know, we were a company that when I first came to work in the early 90s, women still had to wear pantyhose. so you have to, you know, this was, you know, with, there was a dress code. You know, people didn't wear pants. Girls didn't wear pants.
Wow.
So when you think of
how far we've come.
Yes. And I just, so it just, you know,
I think about that fragrance. Yeah. I do wear it. I have all of the Tom Ford fragrances. They're actually one of my favorites. And when I was given that as a birthday gift, I said, wow, that's kind of big that they did that. That was a big deal. Put that title.
That's all Tom Ford. We were smelling the fragrances and he said, that's fucking fabulous.
And that's how it happened.
And we said, yeah. And that's how it happened.
I love it.
John, this has been such a wonderful interview, getting to know you and spending some time.
Well, this has been fun for me as well. I managed to do it with like my computer
that's
going
okay.
to the fridge.
You so did it. It's all good. And it's great content for our listeners. And I'm sure they're going to be so excited. Can you leave us with one final thought just about where you're at the moment and how you're feeling right now?
Well, you know what? I'm feeling the weight of the world right now, because everything actually is important. Yet I'm feeling optimistic that we will come out of this and there will be another place. The future is for the young and we need to spend the time. And you asked a question about mentoring people. I actually am incredibly proud of so many people in this business that I've worked with that have gone on to have great careers. And to me, the ultimate success story or my sign of success is the success of other people.
That's great.
And the fact that they've gone on to do other things and to be successful. So I would say my my words of wisdom, or in this time of incredible disruption, is don't lose sight of your truth and be kind and give back and let others come along the way.
John, how can our audience reach out to you? Where can they find you?
You can find me on Instagram at Jay Dempsey, D-E-M-S-E-Y, no P.
We will make sure everybody knows if they're not following you already. Thank you so much for joining us on the Beauty is Your Business podcast. I'm here with my super fun, my beautiful co-host, Karen Moon.
Pleasure.
And this is Abby Wallach signing off for Beauty is Your Business. Thank you so much.
This has been Beauty is Your Business, produced by Mouth Media Network. Copyright 2020. Keep in touch on Instagram and Facebook at Mouth Media Network, and find prior episodes at beautyisyourbusiness.com and wherever the best podcasts are found. Your brand message can be on this show. Email us to find out more at podcast@mouthmedianetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
This is Mouth Media Network. Amplify and connect.